It is time for this month's Symphony Spotlight, where I highlight the careers of symphony musicians across the nation. And joining us this morning is Holly Mulcahy, concertmaster for the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera. Holly, thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule.
Thanks for inviting me.
I want to ask you, first of all, what convinced you to pursue a career in music, and specifically to choose the violin?
I fell in love with the violin in fourth grade in general music class, and I heard Scheherazade, the violin solo, the concertmaster solo, and I thought, I want to do that. I like the solo, I like the story, and what little girl doesn't want to be a princess? And so I pursued the instrument and kind of guided me along and ended up being my profession.
And Holly was here in Richmond for several years before moving out to Chicago, doing some freelancing, playing with various orchestras, looking for a leadership role, which you found in Chattanooga. So I have to ask you, how did you make that transition from being a section player to a concertmaster, and what are some of the challenges involved?
When I started, I had no aspiration to be in a leadership position. I'd like to be in the middle of an orchestra, but playing in the middle of an orchestra, one finds out that either you like to sit back and be part of it, or you want to lead. And I started to feel like I wanted to lead. So I started watching concertmasters. I would watch concertmasters in the various orchestras. I would play in Milwaukee, Minnesota, Nashville symphonies, Kennedy Center opera orchestras, and I would see things that I liked or see things that I wasn't sure if were working, or I just basically watched. And then I thought, I want to do that. I think I can do that. So I started taking auditions and started getting pretty far and was offered a number of positions and found out I was good at it. I was good at communicating with an orchestra and communicating with a conductor and an audience, which I think are several components in a leadership position.
So as a concertmaster, most listeners know that that means you sit first chair, but there's so many other duties that go with that.
There are a lot of other duties. I just wrote a blog and asked a number of my concertmaster colleagues to join in with me and explain what goes into their perception of the concertmaster job. In general, it is taking care of the bowings, making sure the bow direction of the entire orchestra is choreography together. We're all going in the same direction. And that involves a little bit of mind reading of the conductor beforehand. We'll get any number of parts about 6 to 8 months in advance. And we put the bowings in by hand into the parts and decide what the phrase will be. And then there is the communication of, you know, trying to convey to the orchestra nonverbal communication what the conductor would like to achieve. And then there is the representing of the orchestra. When a concertmaster comes out to take a bow or whatever, you're representing the entire orchestra. So the face of the orchestra, the second face of the orchestra after the conductor, is the concertmaster. And so you want to be very friendly and approachable and open that door to the general audience.
And this has enabled you to be a little bit more innovative with a lot of creative ideas that have come from your chair. What are your thoughts in terms of helping to expand the popularity of classical music and the symphony orchestra?
I think that is a really important thing to be focused on in a leadership position, because it basically is our future is in our own hands. And so opening that door for the audience means being inviting and being able to talk about something that we love, but also listening. I think that's a big thing, is listening to the audience. What do you like? What don't you like? Why did you like it? Or just to involve people into something. And I think that opens the door even wider. And I think when people know that you're listening to them and asking what they liked and really care about the answer, you're going to get more people who are interested in classical music and curious. You're just building curiosity.
And you mentioned the blog. Tell us a little bit more about the posts on there and where we can find this on the web.
This blog is on the website insidethearts.com. The blog is entitled Neoclassical, and it is a blog that I write every month or so, and it covers such topics as what to wear to the symphony, when to clap at the symphony, basically the future of classical music, various aspects that I find are interesting to the audience.
And you also do some work in prisons. I was very intrigued to find out about that. Tell me a little bit about what you go out and do for them.
is something that I just started working on last season. I went in for a recital in Georgia State Prison System, because I thought, oh, this would be interesting to bring music in and share with a population that needs it, kind of as a coping mechanism. And I found out that they enjoyed new music more than Bach. I brought a bunch of living American composers' works in with me. And it's not just a performance. It's more of a two-way conversation. Playing in a prison for orchestra musicians is kind of it's not really a new thing. But what I do with my program is we talk about where the music takes people, how it makes them feel, what images they come across. And it's kind of therapeutic for them to listen, almost as if, you know, they're like thirsty for culture. But it's interesting how accepting they are and how they hunger for new works. It's very interesting to me comparing J.S. Bach and to Jennifer Higdon. The Bach is received very nicely, but the Higdon was amazing for them. So there's a real connection to our living composers that they have found. And with that, the latest recital I've brought into the prison, I took two composers with me, one from New York, Wang Ji, and one from Chicago. His name is Misha Zipko. And they came in and listened to their pieces being played, but they also listened to the prisoners' reactions, immediate reaction of their piece. And I asked the composers, you know, don't tell them about the piece, don't tell them what your intention was. And so they listened to what the prisoners thought about their music, and then the composers shared their own thoughts. And it was a real connecting moment for everybody in the prison gymnasium. But it's a real interesting program. And that is also on my blog. I've got a little segment about that on the blog.
That's really great that you get out into the community, literally. And I know, like many musicians, you do a lot of traveling. I noticed that you spend your summers with the Grand Teton Music Festival Orchestra, now well over a decade. So what's that like, performing with musicians from all over the place?
I think that is one of the best things for a musician in any orchestra, is to step out of the regular orchestra that they are with during the year and get into a situation where you're with colleagues from everywhere, and you can compare and cross-pollinate and share ideas. Hey, what's working in your orchestra? What's working in your orchestra? Or, you know, here's some struggles that are happening in one state, or some successes that are happening in others. And you share ideas, and you share artistic vision. And it's a real healthy camaraderie kind of place to center one's artistic soul.
You also mentioned working with modern composers like Jennifer Higdon. So is that something that is important to you, getting the work of modern composers out into the mainstream?
It is, but I have kind of a barometer of compositions that I pick. If my parents can enjoy it without being terrified, it's going to be something I know that the audiences, at least in Chattanooga, will enjoy. I like to intrigue people. I think it's important getting living composers, because their music kind of reflects our society. They're hearing noises that we hear. Unlike Brahms, where he was walking through the woods hearing the cuckoo, we hear very different sounds in our 21st century. So when I play a Jennifer Higdon concerto or the Jim Stevenson concerto just a couple months ago, these are very familiar sounds, but they're approachable familiar. And I think that there is a certain cachet of having the composer present for the concert as well, which both times I did concertos, they were present, and the audience just loved that fact. But it also creates a perpetuation of the art, because they'll find out, oh, I like Jennifer Higdon, I like her music, what else does she have? Or I like Jim Stevenson, what else does he have? And next season, Chattanooga Symphony is playing, I think, two Jim Stevenson pieces, because we decided we liked them. We liked his music and we liked him. So that will perpetuate the Stevenson in our symphony.
And speaking of liking, I should say loving. I know you're a cat lover like myself, so I just wanted to know what influence they have on your practice routine. Do they like hearing the violin?
Oh, yeah. my new kitten, Taggart, I don't think he's a music fan. He sits and watches me, and I'll play some pretty radical things, some big chords, and he just looks at me, and he makes the weirdest sound. I don't think it's approval, actually. So I'm not quite sure what to think. I'm hoping eventually he will sit on my lap like my old cat used to, but I don't think he's a music lover.
That was Holly Mulcahy, concertmaster for the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera.